Now we're joined by the experts at ETF Trends and ETF Database, the world's largest independent ETF-centric source for top industry news, trends, and insights.
There's a couple of different ways to slice and dice these various ETFs. They can hold what are called total return swaps. Expect the unexpected.
Laura, thanks for joining me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Nate.
Are you ready for another exciting year on ETF Prime?
I am super stoked. Thanks for having me, and it'll be a wild ride for sure.
It will. So look, 2021 was a record year for ETF launches, close to 500 new products, I think 480 to be precise. We obviously had the first Bitcoin futures ETF, the first mutual fund to ETF conversions, really a bunch of new ETF issuers entering the space. I think it was a banner year for ETFs. So before we get to some of the ETF filings out there for 2022, I'm just curious, any quick comments or thoughts to wrap up last year and the uptick in launches and some of the factors driving this? I've got to tell you, I have to laugh just because if you remember back a few years ago, people were talking about the ETF space being oversaturated. And now here we are with record launches. It's pretty remarkable.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Now, I think it all kind of stems back to the ETF rule, which passed in 2019. And I remember coming on the show here to talk about it. It seemed like, a huge piece of legislation at the time. And now I think we're starting to finally see the seeds that were sown then start to sprout, right? So, back in 2019, just a brief refresher, the ETF rule eliminated the exemptive relief requirement, lowering the paperwork cost, the time sink, and the cost hurdles towards launching an ETF, leveling the playing field, so to speak, for newer entrants and for older entrants. And in addition, it also, in addition to making it cheaper, it also allowed newer issuers to have access to what are called custom baskets, which are a bit of a quirk of structure that has to do with how new ETF shares are made and taken off the market and so on. So up to the point of the ETF rule, most issuers had to create and redeem new shares using a pro rata slice of their existing portfolio. Only a few legacy issuers, BlackRock and State Street and so on, had that wiggle room in there. The ETF rule made it so that everybody has that wiggle room to use custom baskets. And that made it infinitely easier for active managers to use the ETF structure, which is why I'm bringing this up, because we saw in 2021 a flood of active entrants to the market. We saw just huge numbers of not only, large existing legacy mutual fund companies come to market, but smaller active shops who were packaging their strategies, their active management strategies, into an ETF form for the first time. And it all comes back to the ETF rule, making it easier for active shops to enter the ETF market and to package their thoughts, their IP, into a vehicle that is more tax friendly, lower cost, and more flexible for the end investor. I think everybody wins.
In terms of new issuers coming into the market, I saw a great stat last week from ETF.com's Dan Mika, who he said this was as of December 8th. 41 issuers had filed for their first ETF in 2021, which amounts to just under a quarter of all ETF issuers on the market since SPY launched back in 1993. I thought that was just an unbelievable stat. I think you're absolutely right regarding the 2019 ETF rule being a pivot point here. I'll just add that I also think seeing white label providers such as Alpha Architect and the team over at Toroso and Tidal, they've really helped bring costs down to entering the ETF space as well. I think they're streamlining that entire process and they're really making it turnkey for somebody who has a great ETF idea and they want to package that up. They've made that just extremely easy to bring products to market. The other thing I'll add here, and then I do want to get to the 2022 filings, and you and I have talked a lot about this really since March of 2020, but I do think the way the ETF structure held up during that COVID crash. I think that gave both investors and I think asset managers just a lot more confidence in the ETF structure. I think that really killed some myths that were out there that, you know, ETFs would bring down the markets or whatever. So I do think that helped as well.
Well, just wait until the next market crash and then that myth will be back, because as long as I've been covering ETFs, people have been claiming that ETFs were going to break the market in some new and novel way. And it's been decades at this point and it hasn't happened yet.
So. I think I just saw another article in the FT yesterday regarding that. So look, let's move on and talk this year. I had a fun holiday week last week. I perused the SEC filings out there for new ETFs. Fun stuff. So though I did have a little eggnog, so not all bad. But I flagged several that I want to get your quick take on. And I want to start with a theme that's found quite a bit of success recently, which is the metaverse and metaverse ETFs. So the Round Hill Metaverse ETF, ticker Meta, great ticker, that was first to market last summer, already nearing $1 billion in assets. And then just last month, we saw filings from both First Trust and ProShares for metaverse ETFs, of course, two top 10 ETF issuers. There's also another filing from Subversive Capital for a metaverse ETF. Its ticker symbol will be PUNK. And then some people may not be aware, there's actually another metaverse ETF already on the market, the Fount Metaverse ETF. But my question to you is, does this seem like it's going to be the next big thematic category, maybe similar to what we've seen with the rash of blockchain ETFs coming to market?
That's a really good question. And I think My hot take on it is that it's less a new category and more an evolution of the same trend that we saw inspiring the first round of blockchain ETFs and then Bitcoin ETFs and so on. So this is like version 3.0 of that trend. There's an acknowledgement that digital assets and digital infrastructure is the way of the future and that the world is kind of spiraling towards a Ready Player One style internet as real life future, and investors want to be part of that. They want to capitalize on that. Now, if you ask me though, I think perhaps the metaverse might be a little thin on the ground right now when it comes to investability. It's extremely early days in this space. And while I think that the Roundhill guys have done really quite an amazing job of finding the possibilities in such a thin marketplace, but even their fund, which is, you mentioned, ticker META, I mean, gosh, they must have had a crystal ball on that one before, because they snapped up that ticker a few months before Facebook changed its name to Meta. Even that fund has non-pure plays among its top holdings like Facebook and Microsoft and Apple and, you know, the same big tech stocks you find in any one of any other million other tech-related funds, right? So I don't really know that the industry has the bandwidth to support more than one of these funds, or maybe one or two. Maybe in a few years, the picture is going to look different. But for now, I think you're going to see a lot of crossover and holdings among these funds and a lot of non-pure play pure play names in the portfolios.
I think that's a good take. I mean, I have said the same regarding the blockchain ETF space. If you just look at the number of ETFs out there and even filings in the hopper there, there are just so many products. And it's such a, it's so early, it's a small market. I don't know that the universe is big enough, but I think you're right in that the metaverse, this is sort of an evolution of that. I think I actually saw, maybe it was last night or even this morning on Twitter, Eric Balchunas talking about a Web3 ETF, which would be the, you know, the sort of the evolution of these. So no, I just think this is going to be an interesting space to watch. And again, Meta, that did have a nice debut last year, launched in the summer and already up to nearly $1 billion in assets. All right. Another category with an uptick in filings is what I'll lump together as carbon. And once again, we had another nice success story last year with a Crane Shares Global Carbon Strategy ETF, ticker KRBN, that took in over $1 billion. But you look now, there's a filing from ProShares for a carbon offsets climate ETF. There are more filings from Crane Shares. I saw a new ETF was filed for last week, the carbon ETF, ticker KRB. KRB from the Carbon Fund Advisors. There are also a bunch of carbon transition related ETFs. What do you think about the prospects for this space? Like, is this a category where you think there's wide enough appeal?
Well, before I answer your question, I want to step back to something you said about the carbon transition ETFs. These tend to be a little different than carbon ETFs like the Crane Shares products and so on, because they tend to, carbon readiness tends to focus on equities, right? So companies that are preparing for a low carbon future versus the Crane Shares KRBN product, which focuses on carbon allowances and that basically a futures market. So, and that's why I think there might be a little bit more room for creative interpretation in portfolios for carbon, for two reasons, really. One, carbon allowances, carbon credits, and all of that carbon trading marketplace, it's a more mature marketplace. You've got carbon credits from California and the European Union ones, and there's a regional US one, and there's a China one, and it's all over the world now. And secondly, you can mix and match these futures contracts by their expiration dates, how you're weighting them in a portfolio, and so on. You do all the sort of things that you do with any other futures-based investment in terms of portfolio construction and management. The question of whether or not the space is big enough for more than one product, I do think that the use case has been proven here. KRBN is an enormously successful fund. You look at the flows into its sister funds, KEUA, that's the European Union one, and KCCA, which is the California one. Those are starting to gain in assets too. And I think it's because the idea of carbon allowances kind of makes sense to advisors. It's not as abstract as, say, investing in carbon transition or carbon readiness, right? This is a concrete way a carbon allowance, it translates into a concrete, tangible thing, a permission to emit one metric ton of carbon, right? So it's making the abstract concrete, and it's doing it so in a very ingenious way by putting the futures market and the investment markets to work to make an impact. And that's something that I know you and I have talked about over the years about the wishy-washiness of impact investing and, are you really making a difference when you invest in, a best of the best in class or, excluding the worst sort of ESG ranking system style ETF? Well, you don't have to worry about that here. You are making a difference, right? This is a very clear way that your investment is making an impact through the investment markets.
Well, to your point, I actually visited with Crane Shares' Luke Oliver, it was maybe about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago on the podcast, and I like the way that he presented this. He basically said, look, you hold carbon as a hedge against other ETF risks in your portfolio. So if you just own traditional mm-hmm. exposure to companies who maybe do have some environmental concerns, he viewed this as a way to hedge those risks. And I thought that was a good way to position it versus what you and I have talked about many times, just the efficacy of sort of this traditional exclusionary or inclusionary ESG approach, which I think, as you know, I'm skeptical as to how much that moves the needle. By the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that there's another ETF filing out there. You're going to laugh. The One River Carbon Neutral Bitcoin ETF filing.
Yeah.
Right? Which will hold Bitcoin, but then use these tokenized carbon credits to try and offer carbon neutral exposure to Bitcoin. I guess on the topic of crypto ETFs, I don't want to spend too much time here, as I'll be covering this later with Bloomberg's James Seifert, but we did get the first Bitcoin futures ETF last year. Still no spot Bitcoin ETF. There are several, or at least there were several other Ether futures ETF filings. I think all of those have been pulled. But any mm-hmm. quick thoughts on what we might see out of crypto ETFs this year?
Well, a spot ETF isn't going to happen. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen anytime soon. Ether futures, probably not going to happen either. And the reason for that is the SEC has made it clear that Bitcoin is kind of the only cryptocurrency that they're interested in. Ether has sort of a dual or multifaceted nature as both a currency, but also, smart contract structure. So it's more than just your average bear when it comes to cryptocurrency. And I think maybe Gensler and company don't really want to wade into that. There was one interesting filing, which was the VanEck. There was actually a VanEck filing for a gold and Bitcoin strategy ETF that would hold both Bitcoin futures and gold futures. And I think, in terms of approval, this is, you know, probably going to be approved because gold futures ETFs are approved and Bitcoin futures ETFs are approved. So why wouldn't this one also be approved? But I think it's interesting because it's pairing gold and Bitcoin together. And those two are sometimes, and I think mistakenly, said that Bitcoin is going to replace gold, or Bitcoin is the new gold, or that people hold Bitcoin for the same reasons that they hold gold. And I don't think that's true always. They don't really serve the same functions in a portfolio. But I think it's interesting that they would pair those two together and get two very different exposures, within the same fund. So I would be interested to keep my eye on that one if and when it launches to see what happens with folks.
Yeah, I actually flagged that filing as well. To me, I think it's an interesting approach. I think the challenge is going to be from a marketing perspective, because gold bugs and sort of the Bitcoin maxis tend to be they tend to go at each other's throats. And so who are you marketing to here, right? Are you going to market to the gold crowd? Are you going to market to the Bitcoin crowd? For better or worse, again, those two tend to go at each other, to what you were saying, in that, Bitcoin's a digital gold. It's gold 2.0. It's going to replace gold. So I think the marketing side of the equation will be the challenge there for VanEck. But I agree that that'll be approved. And I'll just say, I also agree with you that I don't think we'll see a spot Bitcoin ETF in 2022. However, I do think that we'll see an Ether futures ETF. I'm going to talk about this later in the podcast, but I'm more optimistic there just because there are CME traded Ether futures. And I just think for consistency, the SEC is going to have a bit of a more difficult time not approving that after approving the CME traded Bitcoin futures ETFs. All right. We have time for a couple more filings that stood out to me. And I know you and I could talk all day about this stuff, but I'm going to go with Capital Group finally getting involved in ETFs, American funds. So they're coming to market, I believe, this quarter. Just briefly, what sort of expectations do you have for these ETFs?
This is a really interesting question. I'm kind of just a big question mark at this point because, on the one hand, they are a huge player in the mutual fund space. I think they could probably have a lot of BYOA assets to deploy, and BYOA, by that I mean bring your own assets. So, they take their client assets and put it into their own funds. It kind of what with JP Morgan did with the beta builders, and Dimension did with its conversions, and so on and so forth. So, but, you look at, some of the other mutual fund issuers who have come to the ETF table, and there's been mixed success, right? Some of them have found, right out of the gate success with Dimensional. American Century starting to get some traction too. And then some other folks are having a little bit more trouble amassing assets. And you can argue that it might be because they don't understand how to market ETFs, or because maybe they're using the semi-transparent structure and investors don't really trust that yet, or maybe they don't get ETF distribution or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of explanations, and I don't know what is the right one, or if any of them are the right one, or if there is only one right one. But the fact is that not all mutual fund issuers with an incredibly strong mutual fund brand have found success in the ETF space. So there may be a lot of pent-up demand among existing American funds users for an ETF version of those funds. Outside that, I have genuinely no idea, and I think only time is going to tell.
I think the challenge here is where exactly these products fit. And look,
yeah,
I think American funds, I'm sure they do a great job at what they do. But if you look at the trends, obviously the trend has been towards very cheap core exposure, the Vanguards and the iShares of the world. And then on the other end, the hot sauce in a portfolio. I know Eric Balchunas at Bloomberg and James Seifert, they like to talk about that with issuers like ARK Invest. And these seem to sit in no man's land a little bit. And last I saw, the fees on these ETFs, they weren't even cheaper than the cheapest mutual fund share class, which I thought was a bit surprising. So it's just where are these going to fit? Is there enough excitement, enough juice around these products to get investors interested? And are they differentiated enough? Or are people just going to
think?
Yeah, go ahead.
The point you made about fees is just so crucial. I think we've sort of gotten tired of hearing about the fee war and how, you know, everybody's lowering their fees and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's still so true that if you're above a certain threshold of expense ratio, whether that's 20 basis points or 25 basis points, it seems to be lowering every year. But if you're above that threshold, you are really going to struggle to get investors to care about your fund. It just is the way that it is, unless you were offering that hot sauce, right, to your portfolio, unless you were really coming out of the gate strong with a new and differentiated thematic, usually thematic, take on the markets. It's pretty much core, low cost all the way.
100% agree. All right, in about a minute left, the last batch of filings I want to get your take on, and I'll just lump these together. It's all of these filings from smaller niche managers, and I'll give you two good examples. So I love these. Poppy's Money ETF, and then there's this Return on Character ETF. And perhaps this goes back to how we started the conversation, but it does seem like there are a lot more smaller asset managers getting involved in ETFs now. I guess, do you think that does just go back to what we were talking about earlier, that these barriers to entry have come down? It's much easier to launch products. And so we're going to see more of these niche managers getting involved?
Yeah, and I hope we continue to do so, right? So one of the things I've always loved about this particular corner of the investment markets is that, you know, the little guy can thrive. The little guy can strike out with a great idea. And, you know, there's the myth, right? Or there has been in the past, the myth of the little guy striking out and somehow landing with a, you know, $100 million or even a $1 billion fund. And, you know, it's in recent years become more and more difficult for smaller issuers to strike gold or strike oil or however you want to go with the metaphor there. But, you know, I think the ETF rule has leveled the playing field quite a bit so that some of these smaller issuers can have a more even chance. White label issuers like Alpha Architect, both of those funds you mentioned are on the Alpha Architect label. And the operational reason for using a white label issuer in the land of the ETF rule might be, you know, there's really no, you don't have to go with them to get their exemptive relief anymore or anything, but having somebody on your side who understands ETF markets, understands ETF distribution, who can get your idea out there, to the right people, to the right investors, that's phenomenal. I think there's going to be a role for white label issuers like Alpha Architect and Toroso and others in the future, helping specifically those little guys and gals getting their ideas out there. I think it's a really exciting time. This is so cool. I haven't been this energized about the ETF industry in a long time. We live in exciting times.
I absolutely love it. I love seeing the smaller issuers getting more involved here. I love the entrepreneurial spirit of the ETF industry. We always talk about how ETFs are the Silicon Valley of asset management,
Yeah. And
we're seeing that more and more. Now, I will say, you know, look, how do some of these ETFs find success? We always talk about how the ETF is a terror dome. It is tough to compete, but I love that because the barriers to entry to the space have come down and costs have come down, these smaller issuers aren't afraid to come and compete here. And that's how you get innovation in the space. That's how you get unique strategies on the market. And I think we saw, if we look at flows last year, I think something like $250 billion or $300 billion went to issuers outside of the big three. That's a big number. And that shows that while the overall ETF industry pie is growing, that portion for these niche managers is also growing, and there's a lot of opportunity there, and I think we'll continue seeing that moving forward. But Laura, this will be another fun year in ETFs. Certainly no shortage of stuff for us to chat about, but thank you for joining me, and again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and thanks again for having me.
That was Laura Krieger, Managing Editor of ETF Trends.